Happy New Year. I hope your 2020 is starting off with a bang. Thank you for listening to Author Stories through 2019 and all of the previous years. We had an amazing year last year and looking forward to doing bigger and better things this year. Today's episode is with Lee Goldberg, and I thought this was a phenomenal interview to start the year off. There's so much good stuff in here. I think you're really going to love it. He's got a brand new book out. We're going to talk all about it and his amazing journey to become the writer that he is now. You'll recognize the things he's worked on, like Monk and so many other things. Plus, he's an amazing crime novelist that I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. Before we get into the interview, we're going to thank a couple of sponsors who make the show possible. Please give them a shout out and look them up on Amazon and make sure that you tell them that you appreciate their sponsorship of Author Stories. At the end of the show, we're going to have an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War. This audio clip is narrated by the one and only Luke Daniels. You're going to love this series. I love it so much. And Richard has been a great supporter and sponsor of the show, and we're going to show him some love. Listen to the audiobook excerpt. You're going to love it, and be sure to go to audible.com to purchase it. If you're not an Audible subscriber, you can get a free book just by signing up for a free trial at audibletrial.com/Hank. You get a 30-day free trial. You get the free book. If you decide to cancel your Audible subscription, you get to keep the free book, and it doesn't cost you a single penny. audibletrial.com/Hank, and listen after the show for the clip from Richard Fox.
We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters. That's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. picoshouse.com/newsletters. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2 are only 99 cents for a limited time. The gods are rightfully imprisoned, and Cess intends to keep them that way. But her terrorist father has other plans. Gregory D. Little's Unwilling Souls is a pulse-pounding chase through an epic fantasy world of adventure, sinister conspiracy, and a magical industrial revolution fueled by harvested human souls. Cess is the daughter of powerful parents who would very much like to kill one another and who therefore pretend she doesn't exist. An apprentice jailer of the gods, Cess spends her days learning to forge the tools needed to maintain the gods' prison. When her terrorist father attacks the prison on her 16th birthday, Cess is forced to flee after the secret of her parentage is revealed. Suddenly on the wrong side of the law, Cess realizes the very father who abandoned her may be the only one who can protect her. But some secrets are darker than parentage. On her way to find her father, Cess will uncover truths about her family and herself that will shatter her understanding of the world and risk the return of the gods themselves. Unwilling Souls and its sequel, Ungrateful God, are on sale now for only 99 cents. The third book of the series is coming early next year, so now is the perfect time to get up to speed. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2, only 99 cents for a limited time. Writers, I have an amazing tool to tell you about. A revolutionary writing tool for planning stories, Campfire Pro, is what novelists need to go from the seed of an idea to a detailed plan that's ready to be executed. Complete your character design, create a timeline, and track your world building all in one place with our downloadable desktop app for Mac and PC. Without the annoying subscription model so many apps are using today. Visit campfiretechnology.com for special holiday pricing on Campfire Pro today. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Lee Goldberg on the show with me today. He has an amazing new book, the first in a brand new series, the Eve Ronan series, and the book is called Lost Hills, and it is such an amazing read. I think you guys are really going to love this book. Welcome to the show, Lee.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Lee, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, wow. That's a darn good question. Because I honestly don't know. I've always wanted to do it. In fact, my mom has, those huge pieces of lined paper we got when we were in kindergarten.
Oh, sure.
In our first writing. Well, my mom has one of those framed in which I wrote, I want to tell stories. So I knew when I was in kindergarten that I wanted to do what I'm doing now. So I don't know a moment when I discovered I want to be a writer, but I can tell you the moment I knew that I could do it. And I read a book by Gregory MacDonald called Fletch, and it became a big movie with Chevy Chase many years later, but the book was dialogue-driven. And the dialogue was so good, in fact, that excerpts from the dialogue were put on the cover of the book instead of artwork. And I remember reading that and loving it and thinking, you know, I think I could do this. It really just inspired me. I gobbled up those books. And the fact that it was dialogue-driven, which I think even then I knew would be my strength, I felt it was achievable. Whereas I got intimidated by other books I read that were very heavy on wonderful, exacting, detailed prose and were kind of intimidating. When I saw that this one driven by dialogue, where the story and the character moved in the way people spoke and what they did, that opened the door for me and made me realize it was possible.
Do you remember when you would have discovered Fletch?
I'm guessing it was the 70s. I don't remember exactly, but I think it was the mid-70s. I was still like 12 or 13, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. So did that, that realization that, earlier I want to be a storyteller to now I see the kinds of stories that I believe I could tell. Did that change what you saw as the trajectory of your life from that point on?
Yes and no. I knew I always wanted to write for television, and television is also a dialogue-driven medium. Everything has to be shown, not told. If it doesn't come out through action and dialogue, it doesn't happen. So it kind of reinforced what I felt my future was going to be. And I found myself studying the books I read for how dialogue moved stories forward and revealed character. I remember reading the first Robert B. Parker Spencer novels, which are also driven largely by dialogue, and thinking how wonderfully he did it and used it not just for humor, but also for emotion. But at the same time, I was devouring books by John Irving and Larry McMurtry and a lot of other authors to learn other aspects of the craft, because I knew prose was important too. I mean, I hoped that someday I could be as good as John Irving or Larry McMurtry. I'm not, but I thought that those guys I really admired and wanted to emulate in some ways. I liked the way that both John Irving and Larry McMurtry were able to make reprehensible characters still in some way friendly, or not friendly, but you could understand them. You could relate to them. They weren't just one-dimensional bad guys or bad people. They had levels and range and shadings that made them real human beings. And even, I think the character's name was Blue Duck, the evil Indian in Lonesome Dove. You still understood him, and he still had a sense of humor, which was weird. So in that respect, I learned a lot from those authors, too. But my family was a writing family. My father was the anchorman on KPIX, the television station in San Francisco. And my mom was a feature writer for the Oakland Tribune and the Contra Costa Times. And my grandmother wrote for the Spokesman Review in Spokane, Washington. My uncle was a radio disc jockey. So the entertainment industry and writing were in my world and seemed attainable. It didn't seem like something that I couldn't make happen for myself. And fortunately, I was able to.
Now, having a pedigree like that and a family who, were knee-deep in this sort of business, did you get encouragement from them? Did they recognize this desire that you had or talent? Kind of what was the encouragement level that you got from the people older than you?
The encouragement was, don't do it. Don't do it. Go in the furniture business instead. Everyone's got to sit somewhere. No one has to read a book or watch a TV show. I said, yeah, well, yes, but while they're watching a TV show, reading the book, you know, what are they doing when they're on the couch? They're reading a book or watching a TV show. No, they tried to discourage me from it. And in my family, no one was writing novels or TV shows. They were writing, but not quite the corner of the writing business that I picked for myself. I was writing novels and short stories my entire childhood. I have boxes in the garage of novels I wrote when I was 9, 10, 11, 12, you know, all through teenage life. I kept writing books and scripts and things that I only showed to my friends and family. So they knew what I wanted to do, and they thought it was foolhardy. I put myself through college as a reporter, writing articles for the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, Playgirl, American Film, Starlog Magazine, anybody who would take me. So I was using journalism to pay my bills. And for a long time, I thought that that's where I would end up because that's where I was making money and I was having no success with my fiction. But that changed actually in my, sophomore or junior year of college when I sold my first novel. And it became a success that promptly burned out. I can tell you more about that later. But once I graduated from college, I worked as a journalist for a couple years before breaking into television. And it was after I broke into television that I got back into writing novels again.
Your training and then work in journalism, do you feel like that training and experience has helped you as a novelist? What do you feel like that you picked up from there that is a good tool to have in a novelist toolbox?
Oh, it was invaluable. It was invaluable. Because every time I went to report on something, whether it was a crime or whether it was interviewing someone about their movie or if it was human interest, I had to look at these people in the situation and ask myself, what is the story? And then how do I shape what I'm seeing into a narrative? And I didn't have the benefits of fiction. I had to use real quotes and real facts, but how do you organize those facts and quotes to put out there a story that people understand? And also, what is my angle? What is my point of view? Where do I start? What's my lead? What's my hook? And then I had to be lean because I only had X number of words, a certain amount of column inches to fill. So it was a wonderful training ground. Plus, I met so many different people from so many walks of life that it gave me characters, gave me insights. It showed me things I wouldn't see in my ordinary day-to-day life. I wasn't a reporter. And it also taught me how to be edited. I learned not to have an emotional response to having things cut or rewritten or reorganized. I developed a very thick skin. I could separate myself from the writing. But also I learned some key things about editing and how to focus and how to trim the fat, and how to shape a story and how to rewrite for somebody else's point of view. Because sometimes my editor saw the story differently. Maybe I didn't agree with him or her, but I still had to rewrite the story to fit the story they wanted to tell or the angle on the story they thought was interesting. So it was all wonderful training for being a screenwriter and a novelist. It also taught me to write lean, to be very tight, and not to have any extra words.
That first novel that you mentioned a minute ago, was that 357 Vigilante?
Yes, it was.
I think I know a little bit of this story, but I really want to hear your take, because it was a big success that didn't feel like one.
No. I was an 18, 19-year-old college student, and I had a journalism advisor named Louis Perdue, who was writing these big, bulky conspiracy thrillers like Robert Ludlum wrote.
Yeah.
And we became friends, and he would show me his manuscripts, and I would give him my comments on them as if I knew a damn thing about anything.
You knew what you liked.
The sex scene was realistic, even though I hadn't had sex, or I would tell him about the plot didn't work for me. And who did I think I was giving him this criticism? But we had a very lively back and forth. And one day his publisher, Pinnacle Books, came to him and asked him if he'd write a men's action adventure series, which at the time was very popular. They were the male equivalent of the Harlequin romance. They were everywhere. They had titles like The Executioner, The Destroyer, The Terminator, The Immolator, The Defecator, The Drooler. They all had ER, OR at the end, and some guy in the cover with an enormous gun and explosions and women with big hooters, and they were at finer 7-Elevens and outside military bases all across the country. And he didn't want to write it. I mean, he said he wasn't hungry, desperate enough, or stupid enough to write one of those things. But he knew somebody who was, and he recommended me. So I read a bunch of these things, and I wrote an outline and a sample chapter. And you know, Lee Goldberg is not a very action-packed name, and no one knew who the heck I was. So I came up with the pseudonym Ian Ludlum. So I'd be on the shelf next to Robert Ludlum, who was the best-selling author of thrillers at the time, and Ian Fleming. Ian for Ian Fleming. So people would go, Ian Ludlum. You know, I think I read something by him. It wasn't bad. And the book came out the same week this guy Bernard Goetz blew away some muggers on a New York subway train. So vigilantes were hot. 357 Vigilante became an instant bestseller. New World Pictures swooped in and got the movie rights and hired me to write the script. I wrote the script. The movie never got made, but my screenwriting career was born because of that. Pinnacle Books, I did three more vigilante novels, but before I got my first royalty check, the publishing company went out of business, and the fourth book never appeared. So I never reaped the financial benefits of the success of the vigilante novels, and the movie never got made. So when I graduated from college, I found myself back as a journalist, working for a television trade publication, and I wrote a spec episode of Spencer for Hire, meaning no one asked me to write it. No one paid me to write it. It was just a show I could write a TV episode. And my agent was a secretary at William Morris. She didn't even know anything about the business. And she did something really stupid. She sent the spec episode to the producers of Spencer. You never send a spec to the show you're speccing because they'll only see the errors you've made. You send it to a different show so they can see how you've captured the voice or the feel of that series. Well, to make a long story short, you know, a year passed by, and Spencer for Hire, they were in desperate trouble, and the producer of the show looked at this giant stack of spec scripts on his desk and happened to see one that said Spencer for Hire, pulled it out, read it, liked it, called me up and said, hey, just came across your Spencer for Hire script. Would you mind if we shot it next week? And then they hired me to write three more, and my TV career was launched, and I've now written and produced, God, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of TV, Diagnosis Murder, Sequest, Monk, The Cosby Mysteries, The Glades, Hunter, just tons of shows.
So as a kid who cut his teeth on Robert B. Parker, to get to write a script for Spencer, a lot of people would count that as a win, and then to have it produced and made and then invited to come back. If you would have had that original, bad experience in publishing in your 40s, maybe you may never have gone back to it. But at 18, 19 years old, that's naturally what an 18 or 19 year old would do. Of course, I'm going to make it. Now I'm going to write for Spencer. But that had to be an amazing feeling.
It was incredibly amazing. I still pinch myself all the time. I was having dinner in New York with Lawrence Block, who's now a friend of mine. But I never lose the kid in me who read Lawrence Block and dreamed of someday meeting him. But you know, now he's a friend of mine. It astounds me every day. I've been so lucky to meet and work with so many of my heroes who shaped me as a writer as I was growing up. It was an awesome thrill to meet Robert Parker. And it was an awesome thrill to meet and work with and become friends with Stephen J. Cannell. And I met Gregory MacDonald, who wrote Fletch. I've met so many of the writers who made me who I am today and was able to share with them my appreciation and my thanks and my gratitude for what they've done for me as a reader and as a writer. Literally a day, it seems, doesn't go by where I have to remind myself I'm the luckiest person I know.
Well, you have gone on to write some of the best modern crime fiction, police procedurals, whatever bucket you want to drop, what it is that you do in, and I can see those influences when I read your work. Not that they're on your sleeve, but I can tell the kinds of things that you loved. And I think I can tell where your passion is when you sit down to write. What is it about this,
genre or genres that still get you excited today to write in?
The crime genre, whether you're writing spy novels or police procedurals or whodunits, have built-in conflict and a natural narrative engine. There's always something driving the story forward. And the crime, whether it's a murder or a con or a spy thing, is a vehicle for exploring character and creating conflict between different people. And it just makes storytelling so much more exciting and easier. I don't know that I could sit down and write a novel about a divorce or about a child coming of age. I don't know if I'd be able to find the conflict and the momentum that I need that a crime story gives me. And a mystery or a con or whatever is really just a metaphor for what's happening with people's lives. So I'm always able to use whatever mystery or thriller element I'm exploring as a way to examine people or an issue or the thematic stuff. And it's not really in the forefront of my mind when I'm doing it. I realize that after I've read the book, oh, this is a book about forgiveness. Oh, this is a book about trust. I don't know it until I've finished it, because it's unconscious. It's percolating in the dialogue and in the situations. I'm not aware of it until it's there. And I also see how things in my own life, you know, problems I might be having or tragedies I have faced or obstacles I've dealt with have also shown up in my book, sometimes very overtly and sometimes more subtly. And that's also interesting to see how I've used crime and thrillers to work out my own issues. I think every writer does that, but sometimes it seems more overt to me when I'm looking at my stuff afterward, never while I'm doing it. It's always afterward that I see it.
Well, one of the great things about crime fiction is the availability of conflict. And you know, conflict drives every great story. And sometimes you have to really root around to find the conflict. And crime fiction provides you, at least with the surface conflict, you know, kind of front and center. That's one thing I love about it. It's easy to get in that mindset and then start unraveling the rest of the story if you kind of have a catalyst to get it going.
I never start with the crime or the con or the thriller. I always start with a character and his or her conflict. And the story then becomes, what is the best way to explore that conflict? That's why for me, writing for Monk, whether it was a TV show or my 15 Monk novels, was so easy, because it was, all right, how can I explore this guy's obsessive compulsive issue and the sadness at the heart of it in a new way? And the mysteries always grew from that. How can I explore his relationship with the world or with the people he loves or the people he's afraid of or his own obstacles or his own desires? The mysteries always arose from that. And that's been true of everything I've ever written. I've never started with, oh, this would be a cool mystery, or, oh, this would be a cool thriller. I always start with character. It's always where the inspiration initially comes from. And by starting with character, it means starting with a conflict. Whether you want to be funny or dramatic, you have to have the conflict as the spark.
Well, speaking of Monk, I think this is an easy one to explore this next question I have for you. And we mentioned earlier, when you're writing for television or in novels, you have to show, not tell. You have to, and you know, driving with dialogue helps that. You've got you've got the action and dialogue in a TV script, but in a novel, you don't have the benefit of the visuals. Could you talk a little bit about the difference in writing for TV and writing for novels, and what the logistical differences are when trying to convey the same information but in a different medium?
Well, when you're writing for television, what you're essentially doing is creating a blueprint for a house. You're creating a document that other artisans and experts are going to be using to do their jobs. So a screenplay is what the director reads for how he's going to get his shots, what a location manager looks at for locations, what a set designer looks at for the sets he has to build, what a wardrobe person looks at, what actors look at for what they have to perform, what a network looks at to how to fill the time. It is a working document, and it's not a piece of prose. Yes, you have to tell a story. Yes, you have to create a rhythm and the energy and the feel and the tone and all that, but essentially it is a working document. So the challenge there is to get the story across in 50 pages through action and dialogue but also give everybody else the information they need. It's a different way of telling a story. If it's not said and if it's not seen, it doesn't exist. Whereas in a book, you have to pick a point of view and how you're going to approach the scene, and you have to describe everything. You are inside people's heads. You're creating the world from scratch. You don't have the benefit of a cinematographer, a location manager, a wardrobe person, actors, everything to bring your words to life. You have to do everything, which can also be a license to indulge yourself in overwriting. For me, it was a real challenge when I was writing the Monk books and the Monk scripts at the same time. It was the same Monk character explored differently. And in the books, to deal with some of that, I wrote it first person from his female assistant's point of view. So everything was channeled through her perception. So Monk was still something you were seeing that you didn't understand, that you weren't inside his head. You were still seeing it as if on television, but this time through her eyes, which made it easier to keep Monk alive in the books the way he was in the TV show. I find scripts in some ways easier to write because to describe a room or a place, you just go interior room day, and you mention the key points that are necessary for the crew to know have to be there. You don't have to do flowery prose, as opposed to a book where you have to set up everything. So I can write a script pretty quickly. Where a script is harder than a book is it's hard to get stuff across when it all has to be through dialogue and action, and you don't want boring exposition explaining stuff. You want everything to be organic and come out quickly and freely and in an entertaining way. So in a book, it's easy to fall on the crutch of internal monologue or just omniscient narrator to get across the information you need. Yet I find books harder to write because I have to do everything, pick a point of view, pick the key details that matter that'll get the point across, and then somehow maintain the same sense of rhythm and beat that I have in a TV script or a movie script in the book. I'm very much aware in a book of the rhythm, and if I'm not finding that rhythm, if I'm out of step or out of beat with the music of that particular story. I'm not a musical person by nature, but you know, I can tap along with a song, you know, tap my foot along, and I kind of do the same with a book. Each book I write has a natural beat or rhythm, and I can tell if it's not fitting, and I will cut stuff if I feel it's slowing down the pace, the natural beat of it. But Monk was an interesting challenge because it was the same character but slightly different. The creator of Monk, Andy Breckman, was telling me it's like having somebody else cover your song if you're a famous singer. You recognize the song, but it's performed a bit differently. And he said the Monk in my books is a little sadder, a little more tragic, a little more three-dimensional than the Monk on television. He liked them both, but he really enjoyed reading the books because they gave him some insight into Monk he didn't have, even as the creator of the show and writing all the episodes.
Talking about you know, internal monologue and things like that. I think we've all read books that we love that had a strong internal monologue, and then watch a movie adaptation of that, and you didn't, when you don't have that, it's sorely missing in a lot of cases. And you know, the perspective is just feels off from what you're used to. When you're choosing a new project, starting a new one, you know, Monk was written in first person from his assistant's perspective. Your new book is in third person. And I know you know, have chosen, you know, either one of those for various projects. Is that something that you think about in the beginning? And do you feel like that one or the other, you know, has some bearing on the way the book is going to play out as you write it?
Most of the time, I will choose third person. It allows me to keep the character a little bit at a distance from the reader and myself, so you can form your own opinions about what they're thinking and doing and why they're doing it. I think sometimes being in first person, you reveal too much and you can become too indulgent. And being in third person can, if you want, allow you to go to other points of view. I don't usually do that. I do that in my spy thrillers, for the tension and conflict is sometimes created by knowing things that the hero doesn't know, and going to, and seeing how different characters are moving and plotting and feeling what they're thinking. I like first person because you get right into character right away, and you get into their world and their point of view, and it forces you to stay in one point of view the entire story. And it can be a crutch, I mean, not a crutch, it could be a trap, but also it also could be comforting. When you're in third person, sometimes it's hard to keep things from your hero's point of view naturally and not to fall into lots of he thoughts or to do sort of like a half-assed first person. It's a challenge. But maybe as a reporter, I may be more comfortable, from my reporting background, I should say, being in third person rather than first person. But it is something I think about every book. I wrestled with my current book, Lost Hills, whether it should be first person or not, and ultimately chose to do third person.
Do you ever get started on one and switch perspective? Like, say, or change point of view? Like, this really needs to be third person, maybe after you're 4 or 5 chapters in. Does that ever happen?
No, I've never done that, because the way the story plays out relies so heavily on whether it's a third person or first person story. So I have to make that decision pretty early on. It was a big decision in Lost Hills, whether to do first person or not, because I really love being in the character's head. Natalie was the name of the character in Monk, being in her head for 15 books. I missed that. So I was really drawn to doing maybe the same thing in Lost Hills, being in this woman's head. But I decided with a police procedural, it felt better to be third person. It allowed me to have the facts, ma'am, kind of prose that I thought would make the prose invisible and allow the crime story to carry itself. I think it's interesting. I also have to decide what my narrative voice is going to be. And in the Ian Ludlow, I don't want to confuse your listeners, but my trilogy of spy novels that I've written, the lead character's name, he's a writer whose spy novels start coming true, and he ends up being drafted by the CIA to help them in international espionage. His name is Ian Ludlow. It's sort of an homage to myself. It's the Ian Ludlow thrillers. And when I did the Ian Ludlow novels, I knew my voice. I wanted the third-person narrative voice to have a point of view. In other words, there's funny metaphors and there's a sarcastic tone. The narrative voice is very much a voice. For Lost Hills, for this series of police procedurals, I got rid of that. The voice is very much just the facts. Here's what's going on. And if I found myself saying anything clever, I cut it, or I found a way to put it in a character's mouth. I wanted the narrator to essentially disappear. For you to get so caught up in reading, you're not aware of, in a way, that the narrator is even there. And it was hard for me, but also refreshing. So when I've been alternating between Ian Ludlow novels and Eve Ronan novels, and it's nice to have those two different voices. It forces me to be fresh.
Right. Where did the idea for Eve Ronan come from? Because this is the first book in a new series. Where did she come from?
She was a complete surprise to me. I actually had a different crime novel in mind, one set in San Francisco. I apologize if you can hear the dogs barking in the background,
it's,
by the way.
It's perfectly fine.
I have construction next door, and it's driving my dogs crazy. I had actually had a different crime novel in mind, and I do a lot of research for my books. And for this book, I managed to finagle my way into a homicide investigator's training seminar. Homicide investigators are required to take 24 hours of training every year just to stay fresh. And it's not open to civilians, but I was one of 3 civilians who managed to get into this seminar full of cops. And one of the cases presented was to illustrate how important it is to approach each homicide as if it's the first homicide you've ever investigated. Because if you came to this particular homicide with any investigator's common sense, or homicide investigator's common sense, you wouldn't have solved it. That it's necessary to come into it as a complete virgin. And as I was hearing about this particular case, not only was the case fascinating, but I immediately saw how I could move this case to Los Angeles and how interesting it would be if this was an investigator's first case, one that defied all the rules of how you investigate a case or assumptions about a case. But then how could that investigator be a newbie homicide investigator, because that's usually something you attain after years of experience in other areas of law enforcement. It's a high promotion to be a homicide investigator. So what if I had a character who didn't deserve to be a homicide investigator and didn't have the experience, but got it through some other manner, some other way. And then I started thinking about how much I wanted to write from a woman's point of view again, like I did in the Monk books, and Eve Ronan just sort of came alive to me. A woman in her 20s who's never been a homicide investigator before becomes a YouTube star by virtue of this viral video. She even knows, you know, in my book, Eve stumbles upon a Hollywood actor who's beating up his girlfriend, and she basically intercedes and plants this guy on the ground and arrests him. And it's captured by a whole bunch of people on their cell phones, and the video goes viral. And she's able to leverage that because of other events, other things, into a promotion to homicide. So she's got no experience. She's resented by her coworkers in a job she really doesn't know how to do. And then I start thinking about, you mentioned earlier about police procedurals. There's a real danger. They've been done so much, it's so easy to fall into cliche and also to repeat things other people can do, have done. And, I mean, in L.A., you have Joseph Wambaugh and Michael Connelly who've written police procedurals here. How do you outdo those guys? How do you say something they haven't said or see something they haven't seen? I don't think you can. So I decided not to put her in the LAPD. I put her in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. And then I picked a portion of Los Angeles that hasn't been explored at all, this jurisdiction of the Lost Hills Sheriff's Department, which is this island, a world unto itself within the center of Los Angeles. It's bordered by Los Angeles, Ventura County, and the Pacific Ocean. The jurisdiction includes Malibu, Topanga Canyon, Calabasas. It includes the rural areas of Agoura. It's a world unto itself with all the different classes. It has celebrities. It has the rural poor. It has everything. And also the pressures of jurisdictional disputes with the LAPD and the Ventura cops. It just seemed like a wonderful hotbed of conflict. And I found the story and the character in some ways writing themselves. And I was sort of swept up in it.
It's really a great setting because, like you said, it has not been explored, and there are lots of locales there that are odd, and you can see where this tension starts building, the territorial disputes, and these really weird places that I'd never gotten to explore before, like Mulholland and Mulholland. What an odd place! Odd settings do for storytelling.
It makes it fresh. It makes it a whole new world and a new way to explore human interaction. The fact that you can be in the center of L.A. and yet feel apart from Los Angeles in your own little world is fascinating. And what's interesting about Lost Hills is here we are in the heart of Los Angeles, but also has the largest urban national park in the country. We have the Malibu Creek State Park. We have Topanga Canyon State Park. We also have all these mountains and untapped areas that are almost like something you'd find in the Midwest or in Nevada or something, big peaks and deep canyons. It's a really weird landscape in the center of a thriving urban area. But the cases that my heroine investigates in Lost Hills, but also in the sequels, force her to go outside the boundaries of Lost Hills, of course, into other areas of Los Angeles and Ventura County, but she can explore them from an outsider's point of view. Yes, she lives here, but she's taking a different perspective than Harry Bosch or the characters in a Joseph Wambaugh novel. So it gave me another perspective that, say, Raymond Chandler didn't explore with Philip Marlowe or Ross McDonald didn't explore with Lou Archer, even though that was in Santa Barbara and Ventura counties. It's just, I was very much aware and am very much aware that I am walking on ground that has been trod by better writers than me, legendary writers, and I want to be careful to bring my own point of view and not to repeat what others have done. And it's a great challenge, and I find the way to overcome that challenge is to always stay rooted in character. No one has written about Eve Ronan before, so anything she sees and does will make it fresh if I stay within her character. And that's another argument for having a very lean, authorial voice. Everything has to be experienced through her. So I can't go into John D. McDonald monologues about the environment or the history of the state or whatever. I am forced to see things as she does. And that helps me keep it fresh.
Speaking of research for a book like this, you talked about visiting that seminar for homicide detectives. How does the technology of police work affect this kind of storytelling? You know, Philip Marlowe didn't have those advantages, so you know, police work is going to work a certain way. When you're writing these kinds of stories for as long as you have, how do you stay current and keep the storytelling fresh for, you know, a modern audience?
I stay current by talking to a lot of cops and law enforcement and personnel. I stay current by reading a lot of nonfiction about law enforcement. I stay current by actually reading the textbooks that law enforcement personnel are reading and forensic people are reading as they're educated. I meet these people and I say, so what was the textbook in your course, or what are you using in your course now? And I order the same outrageously expensive textbook. So I try to stay up on these things. But no matter what the technology is, there's always been technology in police work. It seemed cutting edge in the 50s, the technology then. It always feels cutting edge in your time. It'll feel dated 10 years from now when they look back at what we're doing now. I try not to let the technology drive the story, but character drive the story. So how are people are using and interpreting the technology? My current book, Lost Hills, deals a lot with blood spatter analysis and blood work and forensics, but it's not about the forensics. It's about the interpretation of the forensics and what drove those clues to be left and how they were left. It's understanding human nature, ultimately, that solves the crime. So I focus on that. There is forensic porn, if you ask me. A lot of these books and TV shows that just focus on all that. If you look at like Criminal Minds or CSI, you have characters telling each other what they already know about the science of forensics. It's all about the forensics. It's all interchangeable, and the forensics solve the crime. I want this to be about people. So the forensics are just another way to explore character and to create conflict and to reveal different things about the world we live in. It's not the story. It's just another part of the story. So I don't get so caught up in the forensics that it becomes about that. And in a way, I explore that in this book. I have an overwhelming amount of forensics that seem to almost smother and drown my heroine so that she has to say, wait a minute, I got to get back to who these people were and what their relationships were. That's how I'm going to solve the crime. Because it's so easy to get inundated with this stuff. And she learns about that. How do you sort through all the data you're getting? She doesn't have the experience yet to understand what's important data and what's noise and what's a distraction. And that's one of the appeals to me of writing this character. She's deeply flawed. She makes enormous investigative mistakes. She's not Harry Bosch. She's not Steve Carella of the 87th Precinct. She's not somebody who knows what she's doing and has such brilliance that she can see the case right away. She kind of stumbles her way into it. She has an innate skill. She has some instinctive qualities that make her a great detective, but she makes some really dumb rookie mistakes in Lost Hills, and she makes really dumb rookie mistakes in the sequel. I think that's part of the joy for me in writing it, is I can see how she's going to evolve over the next 5, 6, 10 books, if I'm lucky enough. She's not going to become the perfect detective for quite some time. And she'll never be perfect, but she's acquiring her experience in real time with the reader.
Well, Eve is also the youngest female homicide detective in her department's history. What does that afford you as a storyteller to have as fresh a canvas as that? You know, Eve is not jaded by all of the horrors that she's seen or all of the bureaucracy that inevitably, you know, works its way into police work. You know, having someone who, yes, is a rookie and makes rookie mistakes, but is still passionate, you know, for justice.
I am so tired of the cynical, beaten, ironic cop who's got an alcohol problem and 3 ex-wives and is hated by his superior and haunted by the horrors of what he's been through in the war or on the streets or the serial killer who murdered his family or whatever. I'm tired of all that. I wanted a clean slate. I wanted her to be young, enthusiastic, not haunted by anything. No more haunted than you and I are, or anybody normal normal person is by their own past. But no great tragedy in her life, no horrible crime that she carries with her. I want her to be looking at this world fresh so that we could look at it fresh. It's one of the ways I can avoid doing what other crime writers before me have done. She's brand new at this, but it also creates a built-in conflict. Her coworkers don't like her because she doesn't deserve to be where she is. And so she always has to prove herself, which means she's always going to take enormous risks. Now, after this first book, she does prove herself in a significant way, and it changes how people perceive her in the second book. But she's still brand new at this. And that creates natural conflict, but also a way for all of us as readers and me as a writer to explore the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, to explore the Lost Hills jurisdiction, and to explore homicide investigation anew. And having her young also means she's tapped into things that other characters may not be tapped into. And it also forces me to listen to my daughter. My daughter's 25, and if I want to sound young, I better talk to her a lot and figure out what's going through her head so I can channel that into my character.
For sure. I love the character of Eve in this book. Lee, if you've been at this for quite a long time, lots of books published. Has your daily writing routine changed through the years?
Well, sometimes it's impacted by what my job happens to be. For instance, if I'm running a TV series, I can't write according to my natural rhythms. I have to have a script ready every Monday for them to prep, or we shut down and it costs $100,000 a day or $200,000 a day while we wait for me to have inspiration. And you can't wait to write when everything's perfect, when you have your special slippers and your classical music and your Avian water or whatever. You have to write when there's all kinds of noise. You have to write on the set. You have to write on airplanes. You have to write any time of the day or night. So you can't have a system, really, a ritual when you're working in television. You're forced by the demands of production to write all the time, whether you're in the mood or not, and all kinds of unpleasant situations. But when I'm writing on my own, my books, I have not really changed from when I was a kid. I still do my best writing at night. I would say in a perfect world, I get up at 10 o'clock in the morning. I have breakfast. I read over what I wrote the night before, and I spend my day rewriting what I wrote, and I spend my day doing other business. I have a small publishing company, and I have to deal with that. I have TV work I have to deal with. I return calls, but I'm rewriting all day. Then I have dinner, and after dinner, from about 8 o'clock at night till 2 in the morning is when I write fresh. It's when I do all my new work, and I do my best writing between 8 p.m. and 2 in the morning. Go to bed at 2 and start over again the next day. And interestingly, my brother Todd, who's also a writer, is on the same cycle as me. And my sister Karen, who's a lawyer, she also does her best work between 8 p.m. and 2 in the morning. So I find if I can't, if I have a question or a word I'm looking for, I can text my brother or sister at 1:30 in the morning and get an immediate response because they're up writing too. Whether she's writing a brief or my brother's writing a novel, we're there at our computers. And I'm still just like a kid. I'm sitting there at my computer and I'm listening to TV and movie soundtracks while I write. I'm drinking Diet Coke. I am doing exactly what I did when I was 12 years old and dreamed of doing as an adult. As I said earlier in our discussion, I am the luckiest person I know. I'm doing exactly what I wanted to do, exactly what I dreamed of doing when I was a kid, and I still can't believe it. I still can't. My brother and I are often like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is real. My brother and I, we were on the New York Times bestseller list the same week. I was number one, and he was number six. We could not believe it. He and I together, I mentioned Lawrence Block earlier, he and I together had dinner with Lawrence Block in Seattle, and we were listening to Larry tell a funny story, and I remember just looking at Todd, and Todd looking at me, and we didn't say a word, but what passed between us was, can you believe this? What happened was we were having dinner with Donald Westlake in L.A., and we've had these experiences so many times where we've got to meet our heroes and our mentors and our inspiration. It's wonderful. And I've never gotten over the thrill of opening up a box of my books and getting those author copies or seeing my name on TV. It's still great even now. And I fear if I ever lose that, then I shouldn't be writing anymore.
Right, right. Well, when people are hearing this show, it is New Year's Day 2020, and I can't think of starting the new year off with a better sentiment than that. You know, we really are lucky to get to do what we do, and just grateful for the people that listen and read and watch. And I hope we never lose that sense of wonder that comes with it.
My daughter must have been, I don't know, 7 years old, something like that. And I was in my office writing, and she came in, and she looked at me strangely. I went, "What is it, honey?" And she said, "What do you do?" It really dawned on her. She had no idea what Dad did for a living. And I said, "Well, honey, you know the books you read and the TV shows you watch?" And she goes, "Yeah." "Well, that's what I do. I write those stories. I write those books, and I write the stories that you see on TV." And she looked at me and she says, "You mean you get paid to sit and pretend?" And I said, "Well, yeah, actually, that's true. I get paid to pretend." And she shook her head. She said, "You have the greatest job in the world." And she walked away. And I got tears in my eyes. She was absolutely right. People actually pay me to sit here and make stuff up, to share with you what I'm imagining. How wonderful is that? And whenever I hear writers whining and complaining about publishing or television, I want to just slap them and say, "You tell stories. You're not on the street, you know, digging ditches or doing brain surgery or doing law enforcement or doing things that really have a human physical cost and where you're putting your life on the line and you're sitting in an air-conditioned or heated room imagining and getting paid for it. Stop whining and complaining." This is why I think I know a lot of writers who have problems with adultery and gambling and who drink and have drug issues, and because there's a big pressure when you're a writer to always keep imagining because your paycheck is based on your ability to come up with stories. That's a lot of pressure. I don't have that pressure. I mean, I don't drink. I don't take drugs. I've been married for 30 years. My attitude is just very different. I think if you become cynical about it and forget the wonder of how lucky you are to be just telling stories for a living, that's how you fall into drinking and adultery and all these other things that drive you to tell stories.
Right. We could be working construction and pissing off the neighbor's dogs.
Yes, yes. Now, you know, some people are driven to write because they are driven by tragedy and angst and mental illness and all that. I mean, you look at all the writers who commit suicide. I mean, clearly they're dealing with other issues that are making them artists. But I'm very pragmatic about what I do. I know that my mortgage doesn't get paid if I don't write. So I'm very focused on always writing. I don't wait for someone to offer me a job. I always try to have something new written. I write a lot on spec. And I've been very fortunate so far in that virtually – every book I've ever written on spec has sold.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, the new book is called Lost Hills. It's the very first book in the Eve Ronan series. I know this book is out everywhere now for people to buy when they're hearing this. You also have mentioned the sequel. Is it already written?
Yes, the sequel, Bone Canyon, is already written, and it's coming out in January of 2021. And my third Ian Ludlow book, Fake Truth, also already written, is coming out in April. So this is a big year for me. Eve Ronan in January of 2020, Fake Truth in April of 2020, and then the second Eve Ronan in January of 2021.
Man, well, I'm a huge fan, Lee, and I love this book, Lost Hills. There's a link to it in the show notes here for those listening where you can run out and buy your copy. Available everywhere, hardback, Kindle edition. Is there going to be an audiobook edition of this as well?
Yes, there is. I was very pleased by it. I usually am a little trepidatious, or is that the right word? I'm a little nervous about listening to audiobooks because they take a different point of view and different tone sometimes than I have in mind. And I thought that the woman who read this book just nailed it. I thought she did a great job.
Excellent. We're going to have links to for whatever format you prefer here in the show notes. Lee, if people want to read more about you and dig into your massive back catalog and follow along for new news, is there a place they can connect with you online?
They connect with me at LeeGoldberg.com.
Excellent.
And I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, and I'm stalking you right now through your Ring camera.
Great. We will put links to all of those in the show notes. Lee, thank you so much for being generous with your time and coming on the show today.
My pleasure.
Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
The near future. Humanity's only hope of survival entered the solar system at nearly the speed of light. The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, the probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come? Then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making, choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information and found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, it landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class, he thought.
Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed "Answer Me" over and over again as music blared.
"Dude,"
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call. "When did I get this app?" he thought. Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise.
"What?"
he murmured. "Mark Ibarra, I need to see you." The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone.
"Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this?"
"You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right, .doc.
Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
"How do you know about that?"
he asked.
"You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen," the robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa.
"Come. Now." Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub. The blue of the morning rose behind him, where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to his ear, Mark stopped and looked around before deciding how to continue. Spiked ocotillo plants looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
"You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I?"
he asked the mysterious caller.
"You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk. Decayed wood. Used as tinder. Are you on fire?"
the caller said. Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
"If you're so close, why can't I see you?"
he asked. He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow patty.